All right. Well, like I said, the last few weeks we've been in a study on living from a place of promise. So far, we've been looking at the life of Moses and the Israelites, and we've seen this oscillation between living in fear and discouragement and then living in promise, and they can't seem to keep it together. The two big points that we've seen so far is fear and discouragement are our greatest enemies to walking in promise. And second, while fear and discouragement will prevent us from walking in promise, stealing his glory will prevent us from remaining in promise. And then we had left the Israelites standing on the edge of the promised land. They had made it through their sea of reeds. They had made it through the whole Exodus. And they come up right to the edge of the promised land. And then we saw this incredible contrast that I mentioned last week. And we're going to pick up from there. In Exodus 14:31, right after they've made it through the Red Sea, it says, "And when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in his servant Moses." So, all right, great. Now they've seen God. They've seen the power of what he can do. They're trusting God. They're trusting Moses. Short time later, they come up to the edge of the promised land, and we see that in Numbers 13, and the wheels kind of fall off the bus. And so we're going to pick up again from Numbers 13. After 2 weeks, hopefully I've got the redundancy out of the text quote here. But Numbers 13, starting in verse 26, says, "They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. 'We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites and the Muscatites live near the sea along the Jordan.' Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, 'We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it.' But the men who had gone up with them said, 'We can't attack those people. They're stronger than we are.' And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. They said, 'The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people there we saw were of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them.' That night, all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, 'If only we had died in Egypt or in this desert. Why is the Lord bringing us to the land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?' And then they said to each other, 'We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt.'" Wow, isn't that incredible? Well, so far we've been asking the question, why? Why was it that when they came through the Red Sea, they had all this faith and they're good to go? And now when they get to the edge of the promised land, what it is that they've been journeying for this whole time, they totally chicken out and they can't go into the promised land. So far, we've established that it was in part a failure of leadership, in part because the leaders forgot the promise. Number two, we've also established so far that it was a lack of thanksgiving or taking God for granted, a heart issue. We looked at a passage where right after they make it through the sea, they're singing this incredible song of praise and thanksgiving. And then within that same chapter, it says just 3 days later, they grumble against God and they're bitter because they can't find water. So 3 days after watching the Egyptian army get destroyed, 3 days after praising God, they're already grumbling about not having water. So there was no heart issue. There was no thanksgiving. Then last week, we looked at family as an excuse. The verse 3 there in chapter 14 says, "Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to fall by the sword, or get sawed maybe? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder." And so we talked about how that was just an excuse because God had called them to it. It was his promise. He was going to get them through that. And to say, "Hey, what about our wives and children?" That was just a lack of faith. If it's God's promise, he will get us there as a family. And then number four, the last one we looked at last week, because we hate waiting. We hate waiting, and our timing is not his timing. We looked at a passage last week where along the way, along the journey to the promised land, God made them stop and wait and wait and wait. 40 days while Moses went up on the mountain, and they grumbled and complained, and they decided, "Hey, we don't want this God anymore. We're out of here." So today we're going to continue to look at this passage and to see some more reasons why they failed to walk in promise. And again, why are we doing this? Because remember, human nature is the same. If it afflicted them, it can afflict us. So the same things that prevented them from walking in promise can prevent us from walking in promise. So our fifth one, we're going to start off today with the fifth reason why they failed to walk in promise. You know, when you're driving in your car and you look in your rearview mirror, especially the right-hand side, there's writing in the bottom of that mirror? Well, that's it. Obstacles may appear larger than they are, is our fifth reason why they failed to walk in promise. Look at verses 27 and 28. It says, they gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw the descendants of Anak there. So in verse 27, they see the promise. It does indeed flow with milk and honey. Here's the fruit. We have the tangible proof of the promise. But then in 28, they quickly take their eyes off the promise and they put their eyes on the obstacle. The people are powerful. The cities are fortified and large. And we even saw the descendants of Anak there. Remember, big promise comes with big difficulties. And also remember, way back in Exodus, we looked at this a few weeks ago, but when God gave them this promise, when he said, hey, I'm going to take you to a land that flows with milk and honey, he said it three times, and all three times he said, the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites. He told the people that those lands are already inhabited, and he told them by whom they were inhabited. So this is not coming as a surprise to them. But here they only see the size of the obstacle, and they're failing to see the size of the promise and the power of the giver of promise. And this is something that we can still fall into, isn't it? Now, I want to continue here. In verse 31, it says, but the men who had gone up with him said, we can't attack those people. They're stronger than we are. And they spread a rumor among the Israelites, or they spread a bad report among the Israelites about the land that they had explored. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. All right, now let me set the stage here. Right before that passage that I just read, in verse 30, Caleb stands up and he says, guys, hush, we should just go up and do it, for we can surely do it. So Caleb stands up and he gives them this pep talk because Caleb sees that the promise is bigger than the obstacles. But the pep talk scares the daylights out of the rest of the people, out of the skeptics, out of the naysayers. So immediately they go into fear and panic mode and they start a sabotage campaign. Do you see how fear, and in particular fear of the unknown, leads us to do irrational things? They began to spread a bad report, it said. The general idea, the concept behind that is it was a rumor. They were spreading a bad report. They were spreading a rumor mixed with a little bit of truth. Yeah, the people are pretty big and the cities are pretty big. But it's also mixed with a lot of other stuff that I'm going to look at in a minute. That still affects the church today? That still prevents us from walking in promise today. I see it all the time. It's shocking in all the churches I've ever been involved with, churches I visit, this church. When somebody doesn't like something, they gossip. They start a rumor. The funny part is it always gets back to me. I could go around and I could point to each one of you and I could tell you what I've heard that you've been saying. But here's the thing. You see, when we live from that place, when we live from the place of grumbling and gossiping and rumoring, we can't walk in promise. That will prevent us from walking in promise because when we're gossiping and grumbling and spreading rumors, we're making it about us. We're making it about my fear, my insecurity, my comfort, and those things will prevent us from walking in promise. Because to walk in promise has got to be all about him. Now let's continue. It says that they've spread this bad report, but Notice how the story starts to change as they spread this bad report. Now all of a sudden, it's the people are of great size. Now all of a sudden, it's the land devours those living in it. Really? Do you really think the land devoured people? I don't think so. It says, we seem like grasshoppers. Were the people there really that big? Probably not. It doesn't even say they saw the Nephilim. It says they saw the descendants of Anak. We don't know who they saw. We don't know much about these Nephilim or who they were or how big they were, but the promise of God is still bigger than they are. And we also know that they're not living in the whole land. They're only living in one area of the land. So do you see how once fear kicked in, Caleb stands up and says, we should go do it. Fear kicks in with everybody else, and they go into fear and panic mode, and all of a sudden they start to use hyperbole. They start to exaggerate. Suddenly the obstacles are larger than they are. Ever experienced that in your own life? You face a difficulty, and you're focused on this difficulty. You just keep looking at it like, oh my gosh, this thing is in my way. What do I do? How do I overcome? And you just keep looking at the difficulty, and all of a sudden, before you know it, the difficulty is a jolly green giant. So how do we overcome this? Well, it's really simple. By only looking at the promise and the giver of promise. And remember, big promise comes with big difficulties. Look, we know this going into it. We know that if God gives us promise, there's going to be difficulties. And the bigger the promise, the bigger the difficulties. We know that. So can we just decide right now that we're not going to give in to fear and discouragement? Can we just stand on that and say, I'm not going there? And we just keep our eyes on the giver of promise. We just keep looking at him. Look, I don't care how big that is. You told me I was going to get there, so let's go. We just keep our eyes on him and how big he is and how powerful he is. As soon as we put our attention on the difficulty, the enemy slips into that. How is it that the difficulty goes from this big to being the jolly green giant? Well, as soon as we give the difficulty our attention, it's in a sense become an idol. And then the enemy can slip in and all of a sudden he plays with our mind and that thing's really big. You see, the enemy doesn't want us to walk in promise. The enemy would love for us to die in the wilderness as a slave. Do you notice how quickly and easily the Israelites were willing to go back and do that? But that death wish is still real, and it's still from the enemy. He doesn't want any of us. He doesn't want us as individuals. He doesn't want us as a church to go walk in promise. He'd rather see us die in the wilderness. He'd rather see us die as a slave. And so when those thoughts start coming into your mind and your heart, that's from the enemy. And we can stand on the promise and the promise giver and tell those thoughts to get lost. I'm walking in this promise, period. I got nothing else to live for. I'm not going to go die in the desert as a slave. Now, of course, we do have to be practical and prudent. We can't just head off on a suicide mission. That's the reverse side of this. There's promise and poof, we just head off to it. But we don't wait on the Lord for how we're supposed to get there. The Israelites struggled with this too. They would get a command and they just expected it to happen. But remember, it's all in God's timing. So we have to plan. We have to prepare. But all with our eyes and attention on God and getting our plans and our guidance and our timeline from Him. Moving when He says move and waiting patiently when He says wait. And we hate to wait, don't we? But part of walking in promise is walking in His timeline. Because He may give us promise, but it's way out there. Because He's got to do a lot of stuff in us first before we can get there. Just like the journey of the Israelites. They leave Egypt, but along the way, he makes them wait for 40 days while he gives them the law. While he explains to them the importance of worship and presence. He needed to do things in them before they could occupy the promised land. And so the same thing will apply to us. God will give us promises, individuals or as a church, But there's going to be a journey. There's going to be a path to get there so that God can do in us what he needs to do. And we're going to come back and look at that a little bit more when we start looking at the life of Joshua, because there is a great time where Joshua gets annoyed at the timeline and he takes things into his own hand, and it actually worked out well. So we'll look at that too. All right, moving on. This is the sixth reason that we fail to walk in promise and that the Israelites fail to walk in promise. And it's a childhood game that we played on the playgrounds of our grade schools. It's called Follow the Leader. And they failed to follow the leader. It may seem obvious, but they really didn't follow their leader very well at all, did they? Moses was handpicked by God and spends tons of time with God, and yet they don't follow him. As we have looked at, one minute they say they'll follow. How many times have I pointed out a passage where they say, God will do anything you say and we'll follow this man Moses. And then three verses later they're like, who's this Moses? We're out of here. So they've got this great oscillation between yes, we'll do it, and no way, we're leaving. They don't listen to Caleb either when he stands up and gives them the pep talk here in verse 30. They just completely ignore him, and that sets off the whole panic mode sabotage. What Caleb was saying was completely in line with the promise of God, whereas what the people were saying came only from a place of fear. All right, so as we look at this, we can see some lessons in leadership. Leaders are there for a reason. God picks and calls leaders. He calls leaders with purpose and for purpose. If we just stay right there for just a minute, leaders are there for a reason. God picks and calls leaders. He calls leaders with purpose and for purpose. That's sobering. Because when we look at a leader and say, to heck with you, I'm not following you, we've said it to God. And yet that's what we do, isn't it? That's how we tend to live our faith and our life. God calls leaders who have his heart, and yet they're the runt of the family, like David. David was the youngest, the smallest. He was completely discredited by his own father. And yet God says, no, I choose him because of his heart. But we as humans say, he's the runt of the litter. I don't know. Maybe God made a mistake. Right? We do that. He called Moses, who had a speech impediment, but yet he could act with great courage. But yet we would look at Moses and go, I don't know, he speaks funny. I'm not sure I want to follow this guy. Romans 12 in the New Testament tells us that every government authority is chosen by God, and therefore we must obey them. Yeah, that goes over like a lead balloon for us, doesn't it? That nutcase, I'm not following him. He's a liberal, he's a conservative, he's a this, he's a that. But God is in the business of putting leaders in just the right places, in just the right time, with just the right purpose. And so it behooves us to recognize that and to follow those leaders that God has put over us. All right, so now what about the other 10? Because remember, Moses sent out 12 spies, one from each tribe, and yet it says that only Joshua and Caleb come back and say, yeah, we can do this. Weren't those other 10 supposed to be leaders? Yeah, they were. So I guess this also gives us a lesson in the brokenness of humanity. You see, leaders are still human. They still give in to fear and discouragement. And they still will fail. That's why it's so important to pray for your leaders. Imagine if the Israelites had consistently prayed for Moses. Imagine if all of us consistently, earnestly prayed for our leaders, our politicians. Imagine if the people in the church consistently, and earnestly prayed for their pastors. Think about how that would change if we all committed to seriously, earnestly praying for our leaders, our politicians, and our pastors. Leaders are still human. They will still give in to fear and discouragement. All right, so now the next question I could ask is, so how do I know which leaders to follow? In these 12 spies, these 12 Israelite leaders that were sent out, 2 come back saying we can do it, and 10 come back saying run for your life. How do I know who to follow? Well, just looking at that passage, just looking at what we see here in Numbers 13, here are a few that we could take home. First, be careful and wary of leaders who use hyperbole. In other words, exaggerate. Remember how the story suddenly got worse? The land devours the people. When you see leaders using hyperbole, be careful. You know, I went fishing yesterday and I caught a fish this big. You know, all right, whatever. But when you see someone in a position of leadership saying the world's going to end if we don't do this, that's hyperbole. Be careful of leaders who respond in or with fear. Do you catch that? When leaders respond in or with fear, look at the life of Moses. God tells him to do really big things. And Moses always cries out to the Lord. He never complains to the people. The people complain to him. But in every single case, when Moses is fearful, he gets it right between God. He goes to the Lord and he cries out to the Lord, God, why have you asked me to lead these stiff-necked people? But he works out his fear with the Lord. But you don't see him showing that fear to the people and how he leads. Number 3, avoid leaders who appear to be self-appointed rather than called by God. This is the most dangerous one on the list. I have encountered lots of people like this in my life. I'll use a sports analogy. Sometimes players talk trash, but then they can't deliver on the field. Sometimes leaders talk a big game. Hey, look at me. I'm a this, I'm a that. But then they can't really deliver. And if a leader has to tell you his title, he's not a leader. She's not a leader. I had a woman show up at this church once and walked in the door. She says to me, first words out of her mouth, she says, I'm an evangelist. And I said, goodbye. If you have to tell me your title, you're not a leader. There's no trash talking in the church. Just get it done. If you're a leader, just do it. But people who have to tell you what their title are self-appointed. Because people who are called by God do it with fear and trembling. People who are called by God lead with fear and trembling. They don't walk around telling you their title. The next one, look for leaders who act courageously. Man, I see a lot of leaders that act as cowards. Talk a big game, but they can't do it. What makes a military general a popular military general? One who gives orders from the Pentagon, or one who's on the battlefield with his soldiers? Look for leaders who act courageously, like Moses. The next one, look for leaders who remember and walk in promise. You could also add in the concept of vision. Does this leader lead from a place of promise? Does this leader lead with vision that's from God? Or is this just sounding like their own agenda? Does it sound like their own soapbox, pet peeve, whatever you want to call it? We lead from a place of promise and we lead with the vision of God. Look for leaders who spend time in the presence of God. Moses was off the hook on this, man. We looked at that passage last week where he went up the mountain and he waited 6 days before the Lord would even call him to come up any further. And then he spent 40 days in the presence of the Lord. But we see this pattern with Moses over and over and over again, the incredible amount of time that he spends in the Lord's presence. That's the kind of leader you want to follow. That's the kind of person that's worth giving your life to. Is a person who spends considerable amount of time in the presence of God. If you don't get a sense of that from a leader in the church, be very careful. Look for leaders like Caleb who are willing to go against the crowd and say the hard things. Man, leaders who just go with the flow are a dime a dozen. But look for that leader that's willing to stand up, risk his reputation, risk everything by saying the hard thing. The thing that deep down inside you know is right, but it's the hard thing. All the others were saying, no, this is too hard. We got to run. We got to flee. We got to go back to Egypt. Caleb stands up and says, no, we can do it. That's the kind of leader I want to follow. Anyone can run and flee. I want to follow someone that can stand up and take a hill. Listen carefully to the message that the leaders communicate. Moses and Caleb communicated God's promise, and that was a message of freedom. The rest communicated a message of fear and slavery thinking. So as you're picking a leader, are you deciding, am I going to follow? What are they saying? Is their message one of freedom? Is their message one that is based on God and his promise? Or is it slavery thinking? In the church, that's legalism. Someone stands up in a church and says, to be saved, you have to follow all these rules. Or to be a good Christian, you have to do this and this and this and this. That's slavery thinking. That is a person who is held in bondage to his own insecurity. The next one, look for leaders who are humble and give God the glory. This is exemplified throughout Moses' life. He was incredibly humble. At one place, it's kind of funny, because Moses is credited with writing the book of Numbers, but at one point early in the book of Numbers, it says that Moses was the most humble man on earth. But certainly, just as we look at the way Moses conducted himself, he was humble. And he gave God the glory. He wasn't building a monument to himself. That's annoying when you see it in the church, isn't it? When pastors and leaders in the church build a monument to themselves, that's disgusting. Look for leaders who are willing to go with you into difficulty and not stay back in hiding. This is important. If the leader won't do it with you, don't do it. I will never ask anyone to do something that I'm not willing to do myself. And that's the way leaders are. Well, okay, even if we find leaders like this, even if we find the Calebs and the Moses and the Joshuas of the world, even if we, like the Israelites, say we will follow, but we don't, we're no better off than they were. We have to follow well. We have to follow well. We can go through all the criteria and say, this is a man, this is a woman that I'm willing to follow. But then will we follow? And so we have to ask ourselves now, well, what are some of the things that prevent us from following? Because, again, this is all tied to walking in promise. If a leader is brought into our life to lead us into promise, but we're unwilling to follow the leader, we'll never make it to promise, right? Well, one of the big things that prevents us from following well is fear, but we've already talked about that a lot, so I won't talk about that anymore. But here's just two more that I want to touch on. Individualism. Now, I'm actually not sure how much of an issue this was in Hebrew culture, because they lived in such a tribal fashion, but it is certainly a huge issue for us today. We tend to think, who is this guy anyway? Who is he to tell me what to do? We want to go our own way, and we want to do our own thing. It's that rugged Western individualism that is so popular in our culture here in the United States. You go to Africa, you don't see that. But here in the United States, we have such a sense of individualism, we don't want to follow anybody. And when it comes to the church and it comes to walking in promise, that's a huge issue. Because if we're all scattered, if we're all like cats running in all different directions, God can't lead us into promise. Because promise is for a body. Promise is for community. Promise is for the church. And so we have to have a unified approach. We can't have this individualism that is so popular in our culture. And the next one, I think that's a big factor that prevents us from following well, is jealousy. And we definitely see many examples of this in Scripture. They were jealous of Moses. Think of how many times other people argued and were just flat out jealous of Moses and his leadership. The disciples of Jesus were jealous of each other. I want to sit on his left. I want to sit on his right. I'm better than you. Remember the scene? Even one of the disciples' mothers comes to them and says, I want my son to sit at your left-hand side. It's very difficult to follow someone if you're jealous of them, as in the case of Moses, or if there's jealousy among the ranks, as was the case with Jesus' disciples. We will fail to follow leadership, and we will fail to walk in promise if jealousy is a part of us in any way. We cannot be jealous of those who are leading, and we cannot be jealous of those around us in the ranks. God will not bless that. Now, I'm sure there are many more reasons, but that will suffice for today. But the reality is, all of these are based on losing sight of the fact that a God appoints leaders. And we fail to follow well. We have to go back to like his kindergarten and play follow the leader if we want to walk in promise. Well, wrapping it up for today. We tend to fall into the obstacles may appear larger than they are syndrome by taking our eyes off the giver of promise and putting our eyes onto the size of the obstacle. So we must remember that big promise comes with big difficulties, and the giver of promise is bigger than any difficulty. Number two, we must examine carefully the actions and attitudes of our leaders. Do they lead based on promise or based on knee-jerk reactions and fear? Our government always works on knee-jerk reactions. Ever notice that? Something happens and there's a knee-jerk policy. That is not leadership. That is not wisdom. And number three, we must be good followers, not self-centered, not more concerned with our own comfort. Well, it's the first Sunday of the month today, so we're also going to celebrate communion. And the Lord says, when he gives us the instructions for communion, to examine your heart before you come. And so today, as we come to do communion, the thing that I want us to be asking of ourselves as we come here is, how am I doing in being a person of promise? And in particular, how am I handling my fear and discouragement? And how am I doing it being a follower? Or have I succumbed to the individualism of, I'm just going to go do my own thing? And so, as we spend a little time in worship before you come up here, just be asking you those questions and examine your heart. But Jesus, on the night that he was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And after giving thanks, he said, "This is my body, broken for you. Whenever you eat of this, do it in remembrance of me." And also, on that evening, he took the cup. And after giving thanks, he said, "This is my blood, which is poured out for you, a new covenant. Whenever you drink of it, remember me." This bread and this cup represent the greatest promise of them all. This is the promise of eternal life. This is the promise of freedom from sin. This is the promise of life to the full. Jesus said, "I came that they would have life and have it abundantly." And that promise is represented in this cup, in this bread, in this body. The way we do communion here is you'll come up and you'll just take one of the little pieces of bread that's been torn off and you'll dip it into the juice and you'll receive them together. And all who profess Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior are able and welcome to join us at this table here today. So Amy and Karen are just going to go into the song "Enough," because he is enough. No matter what struggle we face, he's enough. And then as you're ready, just come on up and take communion and return to your seats.